Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, all of those places. I have to say, it was very gratifying looking at the comments that many of you have left about this podcast on iTunes. Appreciate it very, very much. We're going to pivot back to campaigns and politics today, and we are joined by Kyle Kondik from Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. And thanks for joining us, by the way, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
You are the managing editor of the Crystal Ball, which is always, you know, that might be a little bit a little bit risky because they took away my crystal ball after 2016. I just had to retire it. They didn't want any have me anywhere close to a crystal ball.
Ours got broke, but we fixed it in time for 2018, so that was good. And we'll see how we do here in 2020.
Well, you know, before we started this, I was saying that I'm still somewhat obsessed by the meltdown of the NRA, watching all of that. As somebody who is this is not my first time at the rodeo with them, but watching the grifters turn on one another, the, you know, Oliver North versus Wayne LaPierre, no good guys, no white knights, but apparently tons of whistleblowers. And I have to say that I wouldn't have ever thought I'd be predicting this, but the NRA is in a lot of trouble. They have been running massive deficits, $40 million a year. They may be broke. They're facing serious legal challenges. This investigation by the New York Attorney General's office into their tax-exempt status is non-trivial. And the exposés being published in places like the New Yorker magazine are stunning, in part because you know that they're getting a lot of internal documentation from within the NRA. So, you know, this is one of those issues, and we're not going to get into it in a great deal of depth, but, you know, going into 2020, the NRA has been such a key pillar of the Republican/Trump base, and, you know, their ability to turn votes in places like Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin could be decisive, because especially because the gun issue has not gone away, and there's a really passionate support for, you know, pro Second Amendment issues. But if, in fact, the NRA is eating itself from within, that could have some implications. But, of course, it's too soon to really say.
I think that's a good point. You know, it sort of dovetails with another piece of news from the last week, which was that, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, which, of course, historically is tied to Republicans, but you could argue maybe is more so over the last decade or more, is maybe sort of trying to angle back to being a little bit more bipartisan. At least that's what they're talking about. And I do wonder how much of a problem it has been for the NRA that it is sort of become like kind of a 100% Republican Party entity, as opposed to a mostly Republican entity, but also that there were some Democrats who would get NRA support. Although, you know, again, there used to be a lot more pro-gun Democrats than there are now. And I would definitely say that the fact that the Democratic Party has become so much clearly the liberal party on social issues, just like the Republican Party has become so clearly the conservative party on social issues, including guns, but other things too. You know, I think that has contributed to some of the voting trends that we've seen, particularly in rural areas and small cities across the Midwest, the kinds of places that really delivered Donald Trump the presidency. The Democratic Party is just sort of, you know, it's kind of dying out in some of those places. And I think the sort of liberalism on social issues is a big piece of that. And again, you know, the NRA is a player in that realm, obviously.
Well, there was a reason why Democrats stayed away from gun control for about a decade after 2000, because they understood, I think accurately, how badly that played in some of those rural areas. And of course, they've jumped back in with 2 feet. And I'm not sure that a lot of the folks who are, you know, crafting the Democratic message understand how much of a backlash that generates. But, you know, you make an interesting point about this Chamber of Commerce story, which was really a huge story, where they were basically saying, we're going to move back to the center. We're going to try to be more bipartisan. Now, there's two ways to read this. One is just simply it's real politic, you know, that they're saying, hey, this Democrats are control of the House and may control the House for some time. And we're a business organization, so we need to have we need to have a foot in both camps. But also, you know, perhaps a recognition that you know, long term, lashing themselves to the mast of the Republican Party and Trumpism might not be a winning gambit. And you point out about the NRA, And there does seem to be, I think this fight that's going on in the NRA now is not really about any substantive issue. It does seem to be about power and prestige and access to the various grifts, and there are like tremendous grifts everywhere. But there are people who were attracted to the NRA at one time because they thought it was a gun safety organization, that they thought it was kind of almost like a social club. And the way it has become more and more ideological, not just pro-Republican, but pro-Trump, and now has just dived in headfirst into the culture wars. I mean, they're, you know, attacking the media and on environmental issues and racial issues. And I think that there's a little bit of heartburn about that as well.
Well, and, you know, to your point, I mean, without getting into real specifics here, I would say some of the content that the NRA has produced over the past few years has been some of the most sort of politically inflammatory stuff I've seen. And again, no names, please, in terms of who's responsible for that. But just, you know, I mean, these things sort of pop up on, you know, my Twitter feed and others. And it's really aggressively pro-Trump and just really aggressively kind of, a cultural backlash. And you do wonder if maybe there was some blowback to them going so far on that stuff, which, again, I really think they did. I mean, it's hard in these days to be shocking about anything, but I would say some of their stuff has really qualified.
No, and it was very, very intentional, I think, that they wanted to take the gun issue from being a public policy issue to being really centerpiece in the culture war. Yes. And so I've described them as the id of the right. And it will be interesting to see how that all plays out, because that whole NRA TV is run by this, now we're getting into the weeds here, run by this PR firm called Ackerman and McQueen, and now NRA is suing Ackerman and McQueen, and who knows what that's about. Dana Loesch, who is one of the hosts, is not actually an employee, according to the New Yorker, of the NRA. She works for this firm, so who the hell knows what's going to happen. So another thing, right before we started this, I was reading this fascinating piece in the Atlantic magazine by Yasha Monk, who's talking about Twitter. And this is a theme that comes up on this podcast every once in a while, that we remind ourselves that Twitter is not the real world. The Twitter is not a window into actual public opinion. But Yasha makes this very interesting point that the problem isn't Twitter, it's that you care about Twitter. And then he makes this point, is that the real danger is that political leaders believe that the views they encounter online are representative of the general public, and they're not. And so the danger is the way in which Twitter, which is a distorting lens, actually distorts the perspective of people who matter. And you must encounter this all the time, this gap between the elite opinions on one hand and the social media opinions, and then what people in the real world are actually thinking. For example, in the Democratic Party, on Twitter, everybody is woke Bernie bro type thing. You know, Twitter mob looking for some sort of heresy. When the reality is that the polls continue to suggest that most Democratic primary voters are much, much more centrist than you would certainly imagine if you were, you know, following the Chris Hayes show and watching Twitter.
I agree that, you know, the New York Times did an interesting analysis about Democratic Twitter within the last month, and basically was arguing sort of the same thing that other piece you cited mentioned, just about how it's not really the Twitter is not really representative of where the party is. And to your point, even though liberal self-identification is on the rise amongst Democrats, I say particularly amongst white Democrats, the party is still split about 50-50 between people who call themselves liberal and people who call themselves moderate or even conservative. And they're still about, I don't know, 10-15% of Democrats who call themselves conservative. And, those are the kinds of voters who, I think that someone like Joe Biden is banking on there being a big enough block of that, those voters to get him the nomination when he is running as probably it's going to be the person sort of closest to the center amongst the Democratic candidates. I've tried to go away from using terms like moderate or centrist, because I honestly don't think they really exist anymore in terms of our, you know, elected Republicans and Democrats and people competing for the White House. But there are clearly candidates who are maybe closer to the center than candidates who are closer to sort of the ideological poles of the two parties. And Biden is certainly running closer to the center and is banking on those you know, a combination of sort of moderate to conservative white Democrats and also African Americans who ideologically actually are, you know, even though they're African Americans as a group are solidly Democratic, actually are not ideologically that that liberal, even, you know, compared, I think, to some whiter voters who are sort of driving the sort of liberal trend in the Democratic Party.
Okay, so this is the great thing about podcasts, because I was going to jump right into your piece that you wrote last week for the Washington Post. It is easy to see how Trump can win re-election. We're going to get to that, but let's stick with Biden for a moment. You also have a piece that Biden would arguably be the most experienced new president ever, and there are upsides and there are downsides to that, aren't there?
Yeah, and it's interesting in that, you know, Americans often want what they don't have in politics, and you could see that in how public opinion changes from one administration to the next. I mean, during the Obama years, the public generally got a little bit more conservative in terms of their viewpoints on certain issues. And then when Trump gets elected, they immediately start to express more liberal opinions. And I mean, the people's feelings on the Affordable Care Act are sort of a great window into this, in that for much of Obama's presidency, the Affordable Care Act's popularity was upside down. And then Trump gets elected, and it becomes a little bit more favorable, to the point where more people approve of it than disapprove of it. And this is a trend in American politics. If you look at American public opinion since World War II, basically, and this is maybe an overgeneralization, but I think it's essentially true, is that, you know, during the Republican presidents, the public got more liberal. During the Democratic presidents, the public got more conservative. And again, I think it just shows this kind of almost reactionary nature of American politics. But for Biden, it would be interesting that you'd have the president who would have the most elected experience of any incoming new president, and for that person, Biden, to replace the first president in Donald Trump, who had no formal military or elected experience. And so it would be kind of surprising, but it would be in keeping with how the public sort of wants what it doesn't have, and can sort of oscillate between very different kinds of politicians. Although at the same time, Trump is definitely an older president, and Biden would be the oldest elected new president ever, which I think goes hand in hand, of course, with having a long time in elected office, 46 years total.
I was going to get to that.
Yeah, and two of those on Newcastle County Council, but otherwise 44 years as a senator, and then also as a senator, and then as vice president. So pretty high level federal experience.
No, this appeals to my inner geek here, you know, that when you wrote Biden's 46 years of formal public office experience would dwarf that of the current leader, Democrat Martin Van Buren, whose 31 years in public office currently stands as the highest total of public office experience of any incoming president. So, you know, this would be unmatched by past presidents. It also reminded us that Donald Trump is, of course, the first president who never had any elective office, no military service at all. So, but also historically, the presidency is not a job that goes to be the most veteran politicians. And you go through all of the senators who were giants of the Senate, had been around forever. But people looked at them when they ran for president and was like, yeah, no. Yeah.
And you know, I think for Biden, too, and we're seeing this, is that, you know, when you are in federal office, you do have to take stands on big federal issues. And Biden has a number of votes and actions that are going to draw attention and potentially negative scrutiny. You know, we've already heard a lot about his handling of Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearing in 1991, and also how he handled Anita Hill's testimony. And Anita Hill still doesn't, you know, feels like she was wronged by Biden in that process. And so that's something that's going to come up. But, you know, more recently, I mean, Biden voted for the Iraq War. He voted for NAFTA. There are lots of things that are going to come up from his past that hurt in a way that, say, you know, Pete Buttigieg, who's right now, I think, sort of the flavor of the month on the Democratic side and very well may have staying power. You know, yeah, he has a record as the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, but he doesn't have to vote on big ticket federal issues. And so he can sort of have whatever opinions he wants. You know, I think you saw this with Obama, too. I mean, Obama had only been a U.S. senator for a few years before he announced his run for the White House, you know, he criticized Hillary Clinton over the Iraq War vote. But, you know, Obama wasn't there, so he could have said, oh, well, I would have voted against it. But we actually don't know precisely what he would have done because he didn't actually have to cast that vote. And I would say in general, the recent presidents have had not had a ton of elected office experience. I mean, Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas for a long time, but I don't think he was seen as a particularly veteran politician, in part because Arkansas is a small state. And I think he, you know, even got criticized because Arkansas is, you know, one of the poorer states. And so, you know, being from that state did not necessarily give him a lot of cachet as at least as an elected official. You know, Ronald Reagan was California governor, but only for 8 years, and he otherwise was known as an actor. I mentioned Obama. George W. Bush was governor of Texas, but didn't really have anything beyond that. And so Biden would be different than a lot of the most recent presidents. The only other one who had really a ton of elected and federal appointed experience was George H. W. Bush,
right,
who also, you know, was the last American president to serve in combat in the military.
You make a point that is it seems a little counterintuitive watching what's happening on the Democratic side, where there seems to be this sort of race to who can be the most woke, who can be the most progressive. And you point out, though, that national polling finds that Democrats are not a mirror image of Republicans, that they are, in fact, less ideological than Republicans and are less likely to express a desire for their party to move further away from the political center. So, I mean, this goes back to the question of the distorted lens that we sometimes get, because, you know, if you're watching the top lines, it looks like the Democratic Party is in this mad race to advance the careers of democratic socialists, to impose wealth taxes, etc. And I do think that most Republicans just simply think that the Democrats are like them, but left wing, that it is the, you know, Republicans are an ideological party on the right and the Democrats are an ideological party on the left. You don't think that's true?
I think it's probably less true for the Democrats than it is for the Republicans, just, you know, in terms of the ideological self-placement. You know, I mentioned earlier that the Democrats are split between self-identified liberals and self-identified, you know, moderates and even conservatives. You know, on the Republican side, it's much more clearly a kind of conservative party, in that about three quarters of Republicans identify as conservative and only a quarter identify as moderate or liberal. And there's just sort of a few percentage points worth of people who call themselves liberal Republicans. And I think it's fair to say that the, you know, over the course of the last several decades, the parties have more clearly sorted into ideological camps. And, you know, you see this on size of government issues, but also on the social issues, which we talked about, in that, you know, there are very few kind of avowedly pro-gun Democrats now, and there are very few avowedly anti-gun Republicans. I think you also have seen this on the abortion issue, which is that there really aren't very many pro-abortion rights Republicans, nor are there very many anti-abortion rights Democrats. And so, again, there's this ideological sorting going on. But I do think that the Republican Party is generally more sees itself as being more conservative than the Democratic Party sees itself as liberal. And, you know, I think it's fair to wonder whether the trajectory of the Democratic primary so far, which I think in many ways has been candidates trying to get to the left of each other, one wonders if the candidates themselves in the Democratic Party are misreading their own electorate, maybe going a little too far to the left, and that might actually benefit Biden even more, because potentially there is a vacuum in the sort of closer to the center area of the party. And look at who decided, you know, I mean, it's obviously so many Democrats are running. There are about 20 candidates, but look at the ones who decided not to run. You know, Terry McAuliffe would have competed with Biden in the more center-left part of the party. So too would have Michael Bloomberg. But those are two relatively prominent candidates who decided to take a pass. And, you know, they may have felt like they were going to be boxed out by Biden. And it feels like it was sort of an open secret for the last few months that Biden was going to run, even though until he actually did it, there was always the possibility that he would say no.
Well, this brings me to the op-ed piece that you and Larry Sabato wrote last week in The Washington Post. It's easy to see how Trump can win re-election. Did you get much blowback from Democrats for that? I completely agree with that. But I mean, did you get any blowback?
Not really. I try not to read the comments section of any article, so I didn't look at the comments.
There were
like 1,000 comments or something on the article that we got, but I didn't really take a look at them. But in terms of on Twitter, which is where I generally exist, I didn't really see a lot of blowback. I mean, I think that Democrats after 2016 are, I think, guarding against overconfidence, which I think is probably healthy.
They should guard harder.
Yeah. And
they should work at that.
Yeah. And and look, I mean, you know, I think part of the reason that 2016 projections, including our own, were off is that we didn't pay enough attention to the fact that it was a the economic news was kind of mixed. You were coming off of 8 years of a Democratic presidency in which the Obama's approval was only, you know, about sort of 50% or so. You know, those were conditions ripe for a party change in the White House. And instead of treating Trump like he was some sort of extreme outlier, which in some ways he is, but if you just sort of treated him as sort of a generic Republican nominee, well, a generic Republican nominee had not a perfect chance of winning that election, but a lot of the kind of basic forecasting models that political scientists have come up with basically showed that 2016 should have been about a 50-50 race, kind of akin to,
yeah,
other years where it's been an open seat battle for the White House. You know, if you look at like 1960 was a really close election, 2000 was a really close election, 76 was as well, even though Ford mm-hmm. was an incumbent, albeit a quasi incumbent.
Yeah, non-elected, yeah.
Yeah. And, I think also if you just sort of plug in kind of basic numbers about Trump other than his approval rating, which is pretty poor. But if you just look at sort of GDP growth, the fact that he is a first party term incumbent running for reelection, you know, that those kinds of presidents are generally pretty well positioned. And that's why I'm trying to emphasize how important the state of the economy is, because, you know, it's sort of bad enough for Trump that his approval rating is in the low 40s, despite the fact that perceptions of the economy are strong. You know, if those perceptions change, the bottom could drop out for Trump. But if they don't, and things the recent GDP growth number in first quarter just came out, it was
very impressive.
Strong.
Yeah.
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 So if that keeps up until, you know, next fall, he should be pretty decently positioned, or at least history would tell us that he should be pretty well positioned.
Except that with these economic numbers, he's still stuck at around 41% or even below that on approval rating. So the counterweight to that is that if that normal model that it's the economy stupid governs, why is it not boosting his numbers more? And isn't this pretty ominous sign for him?
It very well may be an ominous sign. And you also have to wonder if, you know, one of the things we pointed out in this article is that, we're in an era of really high competitiveness between the two parties. There's been the last real presidential blowout was 1984 with Reagan, where he won by almost 20 points. Granted, some of the elections since 1988 yeah. have not been particularly close, particularly Obama won by about 7 in 2008. Clinton's reelection in 96 was relatively easy, and H.W. Bush's win in 88 were relatively easy. But we're still in the longest stretch ever in American history where we haven't had a double digit margin of victory in the popular vote for president again since 1984. And one wonders if we're at a point in our politics where actually the state of the economy and other big picture factors that used to be predictive maybe aren't so predictive anymore because the country's so polarized. You know, I think about Obama in 08, you know, winning by, again, about a little over 7 points. You know, we were in the midst of this horrible economic calamity. George W. Bush's popularity was totally in the toilet. His approval was 30% or less. And by those standards, Obama should have won by more. Now, you could say, well, hey, he was the first African-American president, major party presidential candidate. He probably took a hit for that. And I think there's some academic research that mm-hmm. suggests that he did take something of a hit for that. But you could have imagined that election being a 15-20 point landslide. And I just don't think we're at a point in our politics where that is even possible. So it may be that, maybe another Republican president would be in better shape than Trump right now, but maybe the days of, you know, presidents that have 55-60% approval and win by double digits, are just in the past at this particular point.
So you probably saw this tweet, since I started off by talking about it, we should ignore by, and you can help me with the name here, CNN analyst Ryan, is it Strike?
I follow him on Twitter, but I am not an authority on how to pronounce his last name.
Strikes. I apologize. Yeah, yeah. He had a very interesting a little analysis that average presidential approval ratings through this point in the term via the ABC Post and Gallup polling. Kennedy, 73. W. Bush, 71. H. W. Bush, 70. Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, 69%. Eisenhower, 67. Nixon, 58. Truman, 56. Obama, 55. Reagan, 55. Carter, 52. Clinton, 51. Ford, 47. Trump, 38%. So in terms of just sort of the historic relationship, and especially with the strong economy, that really is extraordinary. You know, that is exceptional. Well, let me go to this question of the economy, because one of my thoughts on all of this, especially when and why I think your piece about how it's easy to see Trump winning re-election, the Democrats need to understand, is that people, have lived under Donald Trump for several years. They've obviously already taken on board and normalized all of his chaos. But the economy is strong. 401ks are really strong. And if they perceive the Democrats to be a threat to that through massive government regulation, through massive tax increases, through blowing up the healthcare system, then no matter how much they may dislike or distrust Donald Trump, they may either stay home or vote for him out of self-defense economically. Now, I obviously am going to factor in things like his comments after Charlottesville. But the reality is that a lot of people do, and this is not a cliche, I mean, they do vote their pocketbooks. And if, in fact, in November of 2020, they perceive the Democrats as posing a real imminent threat to the economic prosperity and to their own economic futures, then the economy roars right back, and it is going to be a more traditional campaign.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, and that's how Trump can win again. I think he probably would need a little bit of an assist from the Democrats, which, hey, maybe they're providing by I think in some ways racing to the left on certain policy agenda items, be it healthcare or the environment or whatnot, whatever one thinks of some of the proposals that have come up this year. I do think the policy proposals have been pretty liberal. If the economic numbers sort of continue to be what they are, you would expect an incumbent like Donald, with those sort of economic numbers to in fact be reelected. It's just a question of what people are judging Trump off of. And look, also, you do have to ask yourself this too: will the key swing voters believe that that Trump has been as bad as the Democrats say he is? And in some ways, the Mueller report, which even I think if you read it generously but also fairly, it does not paint a very attractive picture of this president and his administration. But it may also be that there was a fear that, Trump would launch a nuclear war, or Trump would let the Russians take over Eastern Europe again, or whatever. Like there were all of these sort of
we're still alive and we're still doing okay.
Yeah, and the economy's good. And people may not like the Democrats are going. I think Biden's introductory video was sort of similar to the arguments Hillary Clinton made in 2016, in that that Donald Trump's presidency is this sort of existential threat to American values and maybe even America itself. And I just wonder if people are going to be convinced of that. They weren't quite in 2016, and maybe they won't be in 2020, particularly as they've gone through the experience and they probably don't like. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that a majority of Americans, probably a very clear majority of Americans, don't like a lot of the things that the president says.
Well, they didn't like him in 2016.
That's right.
But still elect him.
That's right. And it may be that voters just decide that, hey, we know this guy is flies off the handle sometimes, but hey, it hasn't been as bad as we thought, and the economy's okay. So hey, we'll give him another term. That's out there.
I can really see a lot of those swing voters that handed the House of Representatives to the Democrats in 2018, going to the ballot box in November and actually thinking that Bernie Sanders is scarier than Donald Trump.
Yeah,
because you have the known bad versus the unknown bad. Okay, so how does impeachment play in all of this? You sort of make a reference to the possibility that if the Democrats overplay their hand on impeachment, that could backfire on them. Of course, there's tremendous debate about that in Democratic circles.
Yeah, and I think there's also some debate about what the actual impact was on Republicans when they pursued impeachment in 1998. I mean, the most immediate conclusion I think you could say is, oh, well, the 98 midterms went really well for Clinton. I mean, by midterm standards, Clinton and the Democrats. And so therefore, impeachment was a failure. But, you know, I think that lingering problems with Clinton, I think, sort of linger or kind of hurt Al Gore to the point where, you know, we talk about what academic models would suggest for an election. Gore did win the national popular vote, but he could have, should have won by more given the relative tranquility of the time. And, you know, by that standard, maybe impeachment did help George W. Bush indirectly win by, you know, bringing Clinton's problems more to the forefront and convincing enough people that they wanted to sort of close the door on the Clinton years as opposed to sort of extending them by electing Al Gore. You know, as for impeachment now, even though, like, the ABC Post poll, I believe, you know, that they they found Trump's approval to be really pretty terrible, and yet impeachment has not been particularly popular in that poll or in other polls. And I think part of it is, there's some sliver of Democrats who are actually taking their lead potentially from Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership, and they do not want to pursue impeachment, even though there are certainly factions within the Democratic Party who do, and Elizabeth Warren, I think, being the most notable one now as a presidential candidate who has called for the start of impeachment hearings on President Trump. But you know, that there may also be a feeling that as we, you know, get deeper into 2019 and into 2020, you know, at a certain point, the public's going to have to render a verdict as opposed to the House and the Senate rendering a verdict through impeachment. And that maybe there's a segment of people who don't like the president, but who feel that impeachment is maybe too far, and that, hey, you know, I'll render my own verdict against Trump. I'll vote no, you know, I'll vote for the Democrat, but that we don't need to, you know, we could remove him from office that way as opposed to removing him through impeachment. And, you know, I think maybe the danger would be for the Democrats is if there really be the party sort of splits over impeachment, if the Democrats maybe nominate someone who is running on impeachment, but the leadership of the in the House is not going for impeachment. And, you know, you could just imagine that being kind of a divisive thing. I mean, anything that anything that unites one party and splits the other, I would say, is bad for the party who's you know, in the midst of the split. And certainly on impeachment, the Republicans will be, you know, almost 100% supportive of not doing impeachment, and the Democrats may be split on it. And generally speaking, I think that's where you see a party get into trouble, when they're on the wrong side of a split like that.
Okay, so back to some wonky numbers that I found fascinating in your Washington Post piece, that around this time in the 1972 cycle, Nixon held only a modest lead over the early Democratic frontrunner Ed Muskie, who in 1968 had been the vice president's running mate of Hubert Humphrey. This is one that I thought was interesting. In late January of 1983, pollster Lou Harris found that former Vice President Walter Mondale led Reagan 53% to 44%. Wow, as we know, of course, Reagan blew Mondale out the next year. John Kerry's challenge to Bush was nip and tuck throughout 2004. And so even though Trump is trailing Democrats in these presidential trial heats, the margins are not overwhelming. And he's got a large and solid base and a good economy, all the things that you mentioned before. This thing is not done. One last point. You have a piece about Trump's primary goal, avoiding a New Hampshire hiccup. In so far, I mean, other presidents have you know, stumbled over insurgent candidacies in New Hampshire. Of course, I keep going back to Eugene McCarthy back in 1968, but there's also Pat Buchanan in 1992. The whole rationale behind a Bill Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, campaign seems to be that he could play well in New Hampshire. So what's your read on that? Because it does seem overwhelmingly likely that Donald Trump is going to be renominated without significant opposition, at least at this point.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I wanted to highlight New Hampshire in the sense that New Hampshire can sometimes be an early warning sign for an incumbent president. You know, usually incumbent presidents get reelected when, you know, 2/3 of the vote there or more. And presidents, incumbent presidents who do poorly there, you know, they may end up being headed for the exits. And actually, I didn't really realize this until I started researching it. But Harry Truman, of course, didn't run in 1952, but he was still mulling a candidacy. And he ran in New Hampshire in 1952 and ended up losing, which was one of the many signals suggesting that he should hang him up. And ultimately, he had been trying to get Adlai Stevenson to run for president for many months. And then finally, Stevenson decided to do it. And Stevenson got the nomination, of course, and ended up going on to lose pretty comfortably to Dwight D. Eisenhower, ending a 20-year Democratic run in the White House. But yeah, you mentioned LBJ in 1968. He won New Hampshire, but not by an impressive amount over Gene McCarthy. He ended up not running for reelection. Ford had to deal with the Ronald Reagan primary challenge in 1976, which was close in New Hampshire and close throughout the nation. And then Pat Buchanan's challenge to George H.W. Bush in 1992, which is really interesting in that, to me anyway, is that you had Buchanan versus Bush in 1992, sort of the insurgent kind of populist candidate Buchanan versus the kind of classic, mainstream Republican in George H.W. Bush. And now the roles are almost reversed. I mean, Trump is the Buchanan-like figure, but he's running the party now. And Bill Weld is, a native New Englander, just like anyway, he was governor of Massachusetts. I'm assuming he's from there, but maybe fact checkers will catch me on that. But also that Bush, you know, sort of Weld is in the Bush role, and the sort of Bush wing of the Republican Party is not particularly strong right now. And, you know, one of the other things to watch is, you know, Larry Hogan, to me, the governor of Maryland, like, he clearly would like to run for president. And I think John Kasich, former governor of Ohio, of course, ran in 2016, would like to run too. But neither of them really see much of an opening on the Republican Party right now. One of the things that you thought could have hypothetically created that opening would have been the Mueller report. But it's clear that the Mueller report is not moving public opinion all that much, and that the parties are very divided on it. You know, in order for there to be an opening for a Republican primary challenge, a real one, Trump's approval would have to weaken amongst Republicans, and there's not much sign of that right now.
Yeah, the other primary challenge that really weakened an incumbent president was, you know, Teddy Kennedy running against Jimmy Carter, and Carter obviously never survived that as well. Kyle Condic, thank you so much for joining me. Kyle is the managing editor of Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. You can find this online, all of the analysis, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.